for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Petit Jean was a slave in Mobile, Alabama during the American Revolution. He did not care about American independence, but Spanish invaders promised him his freedom if he helped fight the British. Petit Jean ended up playing a critical role organizing militias to defeat Britain. Petit Jean is just one of the real-life characters in a new book about lesser-known marginalized people who changed the course of the war. The book is titled Independence Lost, Lives on the Edge of the American Revolution. Author Kathleen Duvall joins me in the studio. Throughout the hour, we'll take your calls. 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Kathleen, it's good to meet you.
Thank you, Diane. I'm so glad to be here.
Kathleen, your book focuses on the wars that took place around the Gulf of Mexico. Tell us about that.
Well, I knew that when people think about the Revolution, and even when historians usually write about the Revolution, you know, we write about Boston, about Virginia, those are the stories we know, and they're great stories about the American Revolution. But in the course of working on previous work, I found out about these battles that took place at Mobile and Pensacola and Baton Rouge along the Gulf Coast, and I had never heard of these. And I started to ask people about them and see if I could read a little bit more about them in what other historians had written. And there really wasn't much. Exactly. And so I think people don't know about these battles that much because the main people fighting there were the British on one side, of course, but then it was the Spanish on the other side. It wasn't rebels. And I think that's why they aren't really part of the stories we know about the Revolution. But that's exactly what excited me about them. I thought, this is something that I didn't know about that I think other people might be interested in.
So the book really revolves around the Siege of Pensacola. What was happening there?
So the Siege of Pensacola was when the Spanish besieged and tried to take and ultimately did take Pensacola from the British. So
we're talking about the year 1781.
Right. So the battle's in 1781. During the American Revolution, there were, you know, we think of there as being 13 British colonies, but there are actually about 26 British colonies in North America, counting the West Indies and Canada and West Florida, which is what Pensacola was part of. Spain entered the war to try to take advantage of this rebellion to Spain and eventually even to Britain. The rebellion wasn't really the big deal in the war. This became a global war, a world war.
What was the population like in and around Pensacola at the time?
So the population of Pensacola itself was fairly small. It was British and French because it had been French before the French and Indian War, before Britain won the French and Indian War. So they were clustered in Pensacola, and then some plantations outside Pensacola worked by enslaved Africans and descendants of Africans. And then the huge interior beyond Pensacola, still part of what Britain claimed as their colony, was inhabited by Indians, by Creeks and Choctaws, and beyond that Chickasaws, as well as some smaller tribes.
And how was the area governed, if at all?
So when the British came to take over the post of Pensacola from the French who'd had it before, the Choctaws came to them and the Choctaws drew a line literally in the sand showing the British, you have jurisdiction about 30 yards from the Gulf. The rest of it is Indian territory, they said, Choctaw or Creek. So Pensacola itself was governed by the British in the same way that many of the other British colonies were. And beyond that, Indian nations governed the land.
And who were the Indians? How were they responding to the British?
So in many ways, when they discussed what to do about this rebellion that led into war, the British assumed that Indians would be on their side.
Why?
Because most American Indians living east of the Mississippi, they're I guess their greatest enemy was American settlers, so British colonial settlers before the revolution, who were moving onto their land as these families really were seeking their own independence, land for themselves, and as part of the British Empire. This was land belonging to Indians. And so the British Empire, when this war broke out, thought, if settlers are your biggest problem, Indians, you will surely fight on the side of the empire. And they promised Indians, we'll keep settlers off your land. What you need is an empire above settlers to tell them where they can go and where they can't go. But when Indians talked about what to do, many of them decided that it would actually be more in their interest to let the British and their own colonists fight it out and sort of try to keep both sides thinking they might enter the war, but keep out of it, not risk their lives, and see what happened.
So you say that this battle that took place in Pensacola is very significant. Why?
So one of the things that happens after the Spanish win this battle, Bernardo de Galvez, who is the Spanish general, takes the fleet after they win. They're able to leave Pensacola and go to the West Indies and relieve the French fleet and Admiral de Grasse, who was there fighting battles against the British in the West Indies. When they freed that fleet, that French fleet is the one that went up to Yorktown and blockaded Yorktown, hemmed in Cornwallis, British General Cornwallis, and led to the victory of Washington and Lafayette over him, which, as we know, ultimately led to the British surrendering to the rebels. And also, another reason was the loss of Pensacola, the loss of British West Florida, was the first colony in North America they'd lost that hadn't been a rebelling. And so it looked like this rebellion might lead to losing other colonies to the Spanish, including maybe Jamaica, which was the most valuable British colony.
And you talk about Petit Jean as very significant in this whole operation. Tell us about it.
So Petit Jean was a man of African descent, perhaps from Africa himself, who had been, who was a slave of the French, had a French master in Mobile. Mobile then became a British colony after the French and Indian War. And then in one of these battles between the Spanish and the British during the American Revolution, the Spanish took Mobile and either recruited Petit Jean or he volunteered to start working for the Spanish. Now, Petit Jean shows us all kinds of really interesting things, I think, about colonial era slavery. When we have this image of slavery as antebellum slavery, plantation slavery, the sort of slavery we see in 12 Years a Slave. This is before that. Actually, one of the places where 12 Years a Slave takes place, right there on the Gulf Coast, but in an earlier era. And I think Petit Jean's life really can surprise us. He's enslaved. Obviously, he doesn't have control over his own work and his own life. And yet his job was to take care of cattle outside Mobile. So he basically spent most of his days independent, on his own, perhaps with another worker, taking care of cattle, bringing them into the city to be used for meat when his master wanted him to. And so Petit Jean was somebody who really understood the Gulf Coast. He knew its ins and outs. And so he was extremely appealing to the Spanish. The Spanish were able to use him as a spy. He spied on the British for the Spanish. He spied on the Chickasaws for the Spanish.
How did he manage to do that and continue to do his work at the same time?
Well, one of the great things about the Spanish Empire is if they want something, they can order people around. So they told his French master, we're going to use him instead of you. And so he was freed from his other work. Not free. He was still a slave, but working for the Spanish.
But the Spanish made a promise to him.
That's exactly right. So at some point in his work, he was carrying messages back and forth. He got to know the Spanish general, and they promised him his freedom, which he got at the end of the war.
He got it at the end of the war. How old was he?
Well, it's hard to say. There's a census that he appears in, and it doesn't show. But he was probably in his 30s or 40s by then. He was married, and he had earned some bounties along the way. He was able to earn some money, and he was able to buy his wife's freedom with the help of the Spanish. There was a Spanish official who helped him negotiate a price to buy his wife.
So was that something that the Spanish and the French commonly did, was to offer slaves their free?
Yes, it was. was. And in fact, at the end of the revolution, after these battles on the Gulf Coast, General Galvez gave freedom to several, we don't know quite how many, but several really important slaves. And to others, those who'd been wounded, he gave $80, which was a lot of money, enough for some of them to at least go a pretty long way toward buying their freedom. And also the Spanish and French government, at least in theory, said that you had a right to work as a slave for money and you had a right to buy your own freedom. So that if you and your master couldn't come up with a reasonable price or you thought your master was asking too much for your freedom, you could go before the court in the Spanish or the French systems and they would set a price.
Kathleen Duvall, she's professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her new book is titled Independence Lost, Lives on the Edge of the American Revolution. And why do you call it Independence Lost?
Well, we think, you know, we celebrate on July 4th Independence Day, the independence of the colonies, the creation of the American Republic, and tend to forget that there were people who saw things the other way, who felt that their independence was more threatened by the fact that the Americans won the American Revolution. And the most obvious people are Indian nations. In the colonial period, most Indian nations ruled themselves. They had their own independence, and they lost that in the aftermath of the American Revolution.
All right. We do invite your calls, comments, questions, 800-433-8850. And welcome back. Here in the studio, Kathleen Duvall, professor of history at the University of North Carolina. We're talking about her brand new book. It's titled Independence Lost, Lives on the Edge of the American Revolution. She's talking about these slaves, the Native Americans, others who played a role in the American Revolutionary War that perhaps don't immediately come to mind when we think about that revolution. And Kathleen, you have a letter written by someone who had an interesting background. Tell us about him and about the letter he wrote.
So this is written by Alexander McGillivray, and he's one of the people that I follow closely in the book.
Why?
This is a complicated story. I really wanted to tell why there are lots of different kinds of people involved, what brings them to the revolution and what they do in the revolution and what happens as a result of the revolution, including the loss of independence for many of them. Alexander McGillivray, despite his Scottish name, was a Creek Indian.
Exactly.
Right. So
yeah.
His father was a Scottish merchant. The Creek Indians are matrilineal. So if your mother is Creek, you are Creek. You get a clan within the Creek nation. And so he was Scottish from his father's side, but fully Creek. The Creeks considered him completely one of them. He grew up until he was about 6 years old with the Creeks, with his mother's family. And then when he was about six, he went to Georgia with his father to learn how to run that side of the business. It was a fur trading business. Learn how to read and write there. And one of the reasons I chose him, he has a fascinating history that I'll talk a little bit more about, but one of the reasons I chose him is that he learned how to read and write. And in the 18th century, American Indians were oral cultures. They gave, you know, long and wonderful speeches that Europeans wrote down, but they usually didn't write. And so historians like historical, like documents
of
to
course,
read.
Right? Of course.
So he learned to read and write. And then when the American Revolution broke out, his father was a loyalist. So he and his sister got on their horses and fled back to Creek Country in what's now sort of central Alabama. And when he got there, he had to, you know, learn again how to be a Creek, and he sort of used the fact that he had connections in the British world as well as was important within his family was important in Creek country to become a diplomat. He really was a Creek diplomat that during the Revolution conducted diplomacy with the British and tried to persuade other Creeks to fight on the side of the British against the Americans and the Spanish. And then after the war, when the British lost, he started to negotiate for the Creeks with the Spanish and try to sort of heal things with the Spanish because he'd been on the other side during the war. But he realized that trade relations with Spain, particularly being able to get ammunition and guns from Spain, could be really important if they were going to end up in a fight with Georgia or other Americans for their land. So this is a and another kind of diplomacy that he started to do after the American Revolution was to work with other Indians, not Creeks, but other Indian tribes in the American Southeast and up into the Ohio Valley. As they in Indian country, there were tremendous conversations in this era about the American after the American Revolution about what are we going to do about settlers if the British Empire is gone and they're the ones who were promising they would keep their settlers in check. We need to band together. And so this letter that I want to share with you is something that he wrote down because he was the one who could write. But he writes it on behalf of the Creeks and also Chickasaws and Cherokees, and they were all at a diplomatic meeting together. So we know that they worked together on this letter, even though he's the one who wrote it down. So what they're talking about in this letter is the Treaty of Paris has happened. The Treaty of Paris ended the American Revolution in 1783. But it didn't settle the border between the United States and Indians, and it didn't settle the border between the United States and the Spanish colonies.
And where were the borders at that time?
So according to Spain, and it's hilarious when you look at maps because it looks so counterintuitive to what we know happens over the, you know, the first half of the 19th century. Spain at the end of the revolution claimed not only everything west of the Mississippi, California, New Mexico, all of that, everything south from Texas and Mexico on down to Tierra del Fuego. But also, because of these victories on the Gulf Coast, Spain claimed everything between the Mississippi River and the Appalachian Mountains as far up in some claims as the Great Lakes. Of course, to the United States, this seemed ridiculous. These were exactly the lands that they wanted to be able to expand onto. And so this is a letter that Alexander MacGillivray and these other Indian leaders wrote to the Spanish king in July of 1785 to talk about these border negotiations that they knew were about to happen between Spain and the United States. So John Jay was negotiating for the United States. If you like, shall I just read it to
sure.
you? And I can explain anything afterwards. So it's, we, the chiefs and warriors of the Creek, Chickasaw, and Cherokee nations, have reason to believe that the American Congress will endeavor to avail themselves of the late Treaty of Peace, this is the Treaty of Paris, between them and the British nation, and that they will aim at getting His Majesty, the King of Spain, to confirm to them that extensive territory, which includes the whole of our hunting grounds, to our great injury and ruin. We, the chiefs and warriors of the Creek, Chickasaw, and Cherokee nations, do hereby in the most solemn manner protest any title, claim, or demand the American Congress may set up for or against our lands, settlements, and hunting grounds in consequence of the Treaty of Peace between the King of Great Britain and the States of America, declaring that as we were not parties, so that they hadn't been invited to Paris, as we were not parties, so we are determined to pay no attention to the matter in which the British negotiator has drawn out the lines of the lands in question ceded to the States of America, it being a notorious fact known to the Americans, known to every person who is in any way conversant in or acquainted with American affairs, that His Britannic Majesty, so the King of England, was never possessed either by cession, purchase, or by right of conquest of our territories, and which the said treaty gives away. It says that the king didn't ever own our land, so he can't give our land away. On the contrary, it is well known that from the first settlement of the English colonies of Carolina and Georgia up to the date of the Treaty of Paris, no title has ever been made or even pretended to be made by His Britannic Majesty to our lands except that what was obtained by free gift, so like that little strip of land that the Choctaws gave, right? By free gift or by purchase for good and valuable considerations. Nor did we nations of Creeks, Chickasaws, and Cherokees do any act to forfeit our independence and natural rights to the said King of Great Britain that could invest him with the power of giving our property away, unless fighting by the side of his soldiers in the day of battle and spilling our best blood in the service of his nation can be deemed so. The Americans, although sensible of the injustice done to us on this occasion, in consequence of this pretended claim, have divided our territories into counties and sat themselves down on our lands as if they were our own. Their own. We have repeatedly warned the states of Carolina and Georgia to desist from these encroachments. But we have received friendly talks and replies, it is true. But while they are addressing us by the flattering names of friends and brothers, they are stripping us of our natural rights by depriving us of that inheritance which belonged to our ancestors and has descended from them to us since the beginning of time.
Wow. He's pretty good, isn't he?
Well, and the result was?
So the Spanish king agreed, and he'd been prepped by this. Alexander McGillivray had been writing to local Spanish officials to try to say, you know, and he says in other letters, we're on the same side of this fight. Spain wants this region as a colony, but Spain doesn't have lots of people to send to it. The Spanish Empire was huge. There was no pressure for lands in the way there was from the 13 colonies, now states. And Alexander McGillivray and other Indian leaders really were able to persuade the Spanish to fund their wars, to work, you know, to speak on the same side in diplomacy. So as a result of this letter, the Spanish negotiator with John Jay does say exactly what McGillivray wants him to say. He says, this is Indian land, and we're here to speak for them as well. Now, the Spanish have interest in that. You know, McGillivray convinced Spain that this is in the interest of the Spanish Empire. Spain wouldn't do it if they didn't think it was. But they felt that the best way to hold off the United States was by acting together, and they came very close to doing it.
And John Jay said what?
So John Jay said, yeah, that's probably right. And so he and the Spanish negotiator negotiated a treaty that the Creeks and other Indians were pretty happy with, but Congress was not happy with. So it dragged on for a long time without getting Congress to agree to anything. And in the meantime, these very lands that were contested were being filled up, as this letter suggests, being filled up by Georgians and Carolinians who, you know, for their own reasons, wanted this land and thought it was theirs and believed they had won it in the American Revolution when they fought Britain.
And thereby the title of the book, Independence Lost, Lives on the Edge of the American Revolution. Kathleen Duvall is the author and professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I mean, when you think about the rights that those Native Americans believed that they had, because they had fought on the side or stayed out of it, stayed neutral, because they assumed that there would be a good outcome. I mean, it's total betrayal.
It really is, and I think you're exactly right to get it. Not only did things not work out the way they wanted, they were thoroughly surprised. It just, at the end of the revolution, I mean, first of all, it was surprising that the rebels won at all. Britain was the most powerful empire in the world. The chances of the rebels winning was very small. They win. They persuade Britain to sort of cut their losses and pull out. But then it's not clear that the United States is even going to survive. It's operating under the Articles of Confederation until 1789. Nobody knows that the Constitution is coming and will solve some of these problems. But under the Articles of Confederation, Congress didn't have power to raise money at all. They could only ask the states for money. Congress was in huge debt to Spain, France, and the Netherlands, had no way of paying back these debts. And some of these very Americans who started moving west, and they'd only been Americans for a few years, right? Many of them actually went to Spanish officials in West Florida, at Pensacola, and New Orleans, and other places, and said, the United States is not able to protect us. They aren't able to negotiate well with Indians. They can't secure our right to land or to markets. All of these things the Spanish Empire can do for us. And so there were hundreds of Americans. We think of them as Americans, but they didn't have particular loyalty to the United States. Were perfectly ready to become part of the Spanish Empire if it could give them the things that they felt they had fought the American Revolution for.
So then you have a battle growing between these 13 colonies, the Native Americans standing in between, and the Spanish.
That's right. That's right. And so and some of it does explode into war, both in the Ohio Valley and in my book on the border of Georgia. At the time, Georgia was really just a sliver. It's basically just Augusta and Savannah, and everything west of that was Creek Country. But Georgians started moving west onto Creek Country, and it became a war supplied by the Spanish and led in part by Alexander McGillivray.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go to Jewel in Johnson City, Tennessee. You're on the air.
Ms. Duvall, I would appreciate it if you could speculate, and this may be a little off subject, but about the reason why our leaders here in the United States, back during those times, and considering all the wars across the southern part of what was the United States, did not try to take over more or all of Mexico.
Well, I think there were some people who talked about it, but at the time, if you sort of think about the geography, the 13 colonies really just hugged the seaboard. I mean, there were some claims to farther west, but only a few settlers had, some settlers had come west before the American Revolution, but many of them went fleeing back east of the Appalachians to escape the violence. And so it was only after the American Revolution they started coming in much larger numbers west. And I think the lands to the west of the Appalachians just seemed limitless. Most couldn't even imagine that they would need to go as far as the Mississippi. In fact, when Napoleon offered, Napoleon got Louisiana back from the Spanish in 1800, and then he sold it to Jefferson, of course. Many Americans thought that was just crazy. What on earth would we do with all of that land? Now, of course, as the caller predicts, it's only going to be a generation before Americans desperately want Mexico and think it's part of their manifest destiny. So I think that's one of the exciting stories about this period, that change.
Tony in St. Louis, Missouri, you're on the air.
Good day. Good timing also, because my question relates to the French, English, and Indian Treaty of 1763, which limited colonial expansion west. And some historians have noted that this should not be underestimated as a rationale for revolution.
Yeah, I'm really glad you pointed that out. It's the agreement in 1763, particularly the British Royal Proclamation of 1763, was part of this promise to Indians in the wake of the French and Indian War and also Pontiac's War, that the British Empire would keep settlers off of Indian lands and certain protected Indian lands, particularly in the Ohio Valley. And I think you're exactly right. This could be sort of written off as a temporary promise, something that didn't really matter. But to the British, this is one of the things that really bothers the people who end up rebelling against the British Empire. To the British, Indians were their subjects, and so were colonials. And Indians might say, "Well, we really rule yourself. We're not British subjects." But in this way of thinking, to the British Crown, they had obligations to Indians as well as to colonists. And one of the things that the colonists fight the revolution about is that view of things. They think they should be much more important than Indians are to the British Empire.
Kathleen Duvall, she's professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her new book is titled Independence Lost, Lives on the Edge of the American Revolution. Short break here, your emails, more of your calls. When we come back, stay with us. Welcome back. the book we're talking about, Independence Lost, Lives on the Edge of the American Revolution, by Kathleen DeBall. She's professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Let's go right back to the phones to Steve in Cincinnati, Ohio. Go right ahead, sir.
Hello, Diane.
Hi.
My first ancestor in this country was a glorious turncoat against the British Army. His name was Noah Mallette. He differed with King George on the policies towards the colonies, and as soon as his ship landed, he deserted the British Army, joined the Continental Army, and then after the war was awarded a tract of land in part of what is now West Virginia.
Huh. Isn't that interesting? And how many turncoats might there have been?
Well, it's hard to tell. Certainly the British said there were a lot of them.
Really?
But it's hard to know how many. And you know, remember, these are all they're all British people at the beginning of the war. So most of them, whichever side they end on, don't think of them. You know, they don't think of themselves as turncoats. Usually they think of themselves as fighting for their liberties. I like the caller's point about a land grant in the West. And I think it's really important to remember that the people who went West, who to American Indians looked like the bad guys, were also, you know, seeking their way in a complicated world, trying to do the best for themselves, seek their own independence in this world.
Tell us about a Frenchman who also played a key role fighting the British. He was among the Cajun settlers, Armand Broussard.
So Armand Broussard was born in Acadia, part of Canada, and was a child during the French and Indian War when Britain invaded Acadia, took it from the French. And Armand's father was a freedom fighter, as they saw it, for the French, for the Acadians, against the British. And the whole family, Broussard's whole family, got expelled from Acadia, shipped out with all the Acadians, one of the real travesties of world history. Many of them ended up in Maryland and other British colonies where they were treated really terribly. Armand's family made it to New Orleans, where they were taken in by the French just as they were leaving at the end of the French Indian War. They were very sorry to again see the French abandoning a colony. But fortunately for Armand and his family, the Spanish were who took over Louisiana at the end of the French Indian War instead of the British. And so for a few years, the Broussards lived in Louisiana, trying to build their family back up. Armand grew to sort of young manhood. And then, to everyone's surprise, there was this chance to fight the British. And so the Acadians, including Armand Broussard, were some of those who were the first to sign up with Bernardo de Galvez as militiamen to fight against the British. And so he was part of the battles at Baton Rouge and Mobile and Pensacola.
Did he survive?
He did. He survived. And he's actually the one person I follow closely in the book that I say didn't see independence lost at the end of the revolution. So he goes back home. The Spanish have won. Peace comes. He starts to buy land, starting with some of his cousins, and then he gets his own land. They're very helpful to each other. He starts to buy slaves because owning other human beings was a way to become wealthy in the colonies. He grows and grows this empire. Today, his surviving his house still stands as one of the biggest plantation houses in Louisiana. And at the time of the Louisiana Purchase, he was able, like many Cajuns, wealthier French residents of Louisiana, to work himself into the American system as well, and to find that the United States, by this point, by the early 19th century, could provide him the same things he wanted out of the Spanish. Security for his land, protection from Indians or other empires, and the security of a slave system.
How interesting. And George in Wilmington, North Carolina, says, "It's my understanding that British also offered freedom to the African-American slaves. Is that true?
That's right. And so when we were talking about the French and the Spanish offering freedom, those were mostly two slaves who were enslaved, people who were enslaved within the French and Spanish colonies. The British story is even more interesting in this case. I think they offered freedom to slaves and indentured servants of people who were rebelling during the American Revolution, and said to slaves of rebels, if you are a man of military age and you can run away from your master and make your way to British lines, then you'll get your freedom if you serve in the British military. One of the great things about this story is that slaves of all kinds came, children, women, people who definitely were not supposed to, the British did not intend to come to them because they were looking for military men to fight on their side. But many of them came. Some served in the army. Many served in the British army. And after the American Revolution, after the British surrendered, those who survived made their way to other colonies around the British Empire, Australia, Canada, Britain
right.
itself.
To Zeeland, Michigan. Hi there, Mary.
Hi. I was as I was listening to the author talk about her book, I was wondering if she was going to mention Alexander McGillivray. I was born in Alabama. I was a McGillivray. And when we were growing up, my father would tell us stories, some of those same stories she was telling about Alexander McGillivray. And when she started reading that lovely letter, I began to wonder where that letter is housed now.
So that letter and this is written to the Spanish. So the original of it is in Spain, in their archives. But there are microfilms of most of his correspondence at the Library of Congress right here in Washington. And I don't know if you've seen it, perhaps you've already seen it, but there's a wonderful volume of typescripts of his letters. So his letters that have been typed up, that was edited by a man named John Coffey, Coughey. And it's, there's a wealth of information in there, all in letter, mostly letters written by him, a few that are to him, but he's a wonderful, how exciting that, that you're part of that family.
Yes, lovely. I'll have to look up that book as well as yours.
Thank you.
Indeed. Thank you so much for calling. Isn't that exciting to hear
really
from
cool.
someone who is indeed? But the kind of research that you had to do for this, how long did this book take to write?
Well, Diane, I'm sorry to say it took me about 10 years.
Did it really?
And it's, it's little pieces here and there. These are people who weren't, some of them were known in their own time. Alexander McGillivray was certainly somebody that that American and European leaders knew about. But many of these people were much less known. Petit Jean, for example, whom we talked about earlier, the enslaved man who became a spy for the Spanish. I was doing research in Spanish documents, the dispatches basically between the Spanish general and his subordinate officers. And I found one that mentioned Petit Jean. And I think one of the first one I found said something about him being enslaved. And I thought, I'm going to make a note of that. And then a few, days later, I came across another mention of him. And so I just started to save up these documents
follow the clues.
Uh-huh. And then he's somebody, I don't have that many. I have references to him in these letters. He didn't write himself, so I don't have any letters from him. I don't even know his wife's name. But I was able to find him in a census later on in the late 1780s in Mobile as a free man. And I found the Spanish correspondence after the war giving him his freedom and helping negotiate the freedom of his wife. So, but that's all I have about him. And everything else I have to build around what I know about slavery in Mobile.
But what kinds of secrets was he able to pass back and forth?
So he brought any kind of information he could bring from the British and the Chickasaws, how many troops they had, when they might be coming. He was able to bring the very good news to the Spanish that the Chickasaws did not seem to be mustering lots of men and maybe weren't coming to the aid of the British, which was very good news for the Spanish. He also used his knowledge of the region to help the Spanish find paths. I mean, think about the Gulf Coast. It is a confusing place, many waterways coming in and out. It's hard to even tell when you've gotten to the main rivers or the main bays. And he was able to lead them to mostly Indian paths, actually, north of Mobile and between Mobile and Pensacola and in the other direction to the Mississippi, and show them the right routes.
But putting together a narrative with all of these disparate groups, disparate personalities who only barely connect with each other, that had to be fairly difficult.
And it's one of the reasons I focused on these eight people, is that they have these background stories. They sort of stand in for large groups of people, but they help to humanize things. Like Paimataha is another person I follow. He was a Chickasaw leader, and he was a warrior before in the French and Indian War, and before that.
And where was he?
So he was in what's now Western Tennessee.
Okay.
Fighting mostly along the Mississippi River against the French. So the Chickasaws were on the same side as the British in the French and Indian War, unlike most Indians, which you can tell by the name French and Indian War. So the Chickasaws fought wholeheartedly on the side of the British. They fought a couple of other wars against the French in the French colonial period. Paimataha, at the end of the French and Indian War, he was growing out of the era of him being a warrior, growing into the period where he would be more of a leader, of a chief. And he rose to the position of lead Chickasaw diplomat. And he saw this opportunity at the end of the French and Indian War that the French were leaving. And he thought, well, the Chickasaws have lost a huge number of people to disease, to smallpox, to war. And we have a chance to be a peaceful people in the future. And so he turned Chickasaw history around, and the Chickasaws during his lifetime stayed out of the American Revolution despite promises to the British to fight on the side of the British. Forged ties with the Spanish and really changed the impression of Chickasaws in the region from being some of the most militaristic and most feared people to peacemakers, bringing people together to make peace.
To James in Bloomington, Indiana, you're on the air.
Hello, Diane.
Hi.
And I wanted to call, and here's my question. My mother's Native American, and my grandfather, we're Mohawks. The government wrote letters back to my mother saying because the Mohawks left the country, although they still resided in the country, but they're trying to say that they left the country, we have no claim to our Native American status. And I'm just wondering, how can a European come over and take the land from the Native Americans, but we have to be on a reservation in order to prove our status? Is there any other way of getting this cleared up? Because we're losing a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's right. It's I'm a historian, but I know about the struggles of trying to establish nationhood and individual citizenship today, and it really is a sign of the ridiculousness of the border drawing that went on in the era just after the American Revolution, that these borders could be drawn between what becomes British Canada and the United States, but goes right across Mohawk land. It was a surprising thing to the people who lived through it, and it's a shocking thing, I think, still to us today, with repercussions, as you mentioned.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, and to Steve in Pell City, Alabama. You're on the air.
Thank you. Great to hear that it's taken you 10 years to write the book, because I'm doing the same thing, and I'm chastising myself for the time it takes. But you mentioned Galvez, and I've been writing on the 13,000 Spanish surnamed Americans in the Civil War, which, as you peel everything back, I've had to go all the way back to the Revolution. And without Spanish influence from the people like Galvez and the Spanish crown, I seriously doubt that America would have emerged as it did from the Revolution. And I was just curious on your thoughts on with Galvez holding down the British fleets and how that led to the victories with Washington and so much of the Spanish history.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Bernardo de Galvez, the Spanish general coming out of New Orleans, was fighting, you know, on the same side as the United States, of course, as you know. The involvement of the Spanish as well as of the French was critical. There's no way the United States would have, the rebels would have won, would have defeated the British Empire without their help, both their military help and their financial help. One of the exciting things that I think relates to your research is that the Sons of the American Revolution have started including descendants of Galvez's troops among their membership, which and have traveled to Spain and met with the king. And I think this, what you're working on the Civil War, I don't know anything about, that's really exciting. But this connection of Spanish-speaking people, subjects of Spain, and their descendants in these wars, not only is tremendously important at the time, but I think it's a really important reminder to us today that that Spanish-speaking people have long history in the history of our continent.
I gather you grew up in Arkansas.
That's right. That's
so
right.
So how did that affect your interest in this period of history?
Well, my first book is about the Arkansas River Valley, but I didn't really intend it to be when I went to grad school. I was in grad school in California. I wanted to write something about cross-cultural encounters. What's always interested me in history is how do people who are quite different from each other or who think of themselves as quite different from each other, how do they get along? And I was sort of fishing around for a dissertation topic. And the place that I came from, Arkansas, I'd had really good history teachers. I learned a lot about really the history of black and white in Arkansas and the South and in the United States, but very little actually about American Indian history. And yet I grew up in a place where American Indian names are everywhere, and American Indians live in large numbers still. And I thought, well, hey, maybe there's something in the colonial period I could write about. There probably aren't any sources because nobody's ever written about it. And I started looking, and there are huge numbers of sources, but they are in French and in Spanish. And most American historians, in the past at least, have not been able to read or work in French and Spanish. And so that's what brought me into my first book, Native Ground. And then it was in the course of that research that I learned about these battles at Mobile and Pensacola.
And the book we've been talking about is titled Independence Lost, Lives on the Edge of the American Revolution. Kathleen Duvall is the author and professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Good to talk with you, and thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.